1 Corinthians chapter 10 from verse 23. Paul continues his argument, verse 23. Everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible, but not everything is constructive. Nobody should seek his own good, but the good of others. Eat anything sold in the market without raising questions of conscience, for the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. If some unbeliever invites you to a meal and you want to go, eat whatever is put before you without raising questions of conscience. But if anyone says to you, "This has been offered in sacrifice," then do not eat it, both for the sake of the man who told you and for conscience' sake, the other man's conscience, I mean, not yours. For why should my freedom be judged by another's conscience? If I take part in the meal with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of something I thank God for? So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the church of God, even as I try to please everybody in every way. For I am not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved. What do you think makes the ideal dinner guest? What do you think makes the ideal dinner party guest? I suppose it's one who doesn't complain about the food. I had a few girlfriends, and one of the sort of distinguishing marks of Caroline, and indeed another girlfriend of my brother, when they came to my house, was that they were not fussy eaters. One of the remarks of my parents is, "How lovely that you've got a girlfriend who's not a fussy eater at last." And so I married her. A good guest doesn't complain about the food. Clears their plate. A good guest doesn't judge their hosts. A good guest doesn't complain about the decoration or the amount of money that's been spent on the house or not spent on the house. A good guest is genuinely interested in their hosts and in the other guests. Are you a good guest? Would somebody like you to come round for tea? Are you a good guest for a Christian, for a non-Christian? Are you a good guest? And that's really what 1 Corinthians 10 is about, in part. 1 Corinthians 10 will help you be the perfect dinner guest, in a way, for the glory of God and for the good of others. Paul's gathering together his arguments since chapter 8, verse 1. He's introduced that subject there, where he says, introducing the new subject, "Now about food sacrificed to idols, we know that we all possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up." And that was how he introduced the subject, has gone through a number of aspects of thinking through. Do you go to eat meat at the idol temples? Do you eat the meat that's been offered at the idol temples? And he's gathering together all those arguments that he's begun back in chapter 8, verse 1. He's clearly stated already, that we looked at it last time, that it's wrong to actually enter the idol temples and join in with the feast. It's really associating with the agenda of Satan and demons. So he says, don't go there. But of course, he has said already, and will repeat here, that there is Christian freedom. There are rights that we have. But we always temper, we always control, we always qualify those rights with thinking about our brothers and sisters and thinking about the gospel. So Paul begins in verse 23 here of the text we're looking at. Everything is permissible. It's a catchphrase that he's used before back in chapter 6, probably a catchphrase of the Corinthians, where they would say in an exhaustive way, really, everything is permissible. And of course, Paul wants to say, absolutely, you are free from the Old Testament laws and rules and regulations, and you're free indeed from any kind of ritual that you might have inherited from your pagan history. So in that sense, everything is permissible. There is a great deal of freedom. Christianity is not about rules. It's about freedom to do anything in a way that God doesn't directly condemn. And yet, chapter 6, verse 12, he says everything is permissible, quoting them, but then goes to talk about them visiting prostitutes and says you're just taking your freedom actually outside of God's will completely. But it's also possible to use that freedom. He's already talked about it in this section from chapter 8 through to 10. It's possible, of course, to use that freedom to do something sinful, but it's also possible to use that freedom to do something that damages your brother or your sister. In the way that you use your freedom, that you use your rights. And again, really, he reminds in this final section of how do we control that? How do we control the possible misuse, the possible damage to others? In this wide range of possibilities of what we can do with our Christian freedom, there are other factors, and he talks about them here. What will be beneficial? What will build up? You see that verse 23, verse 24, and the same as how he began that section in chapter 8, verse 1. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And then again, the same phrase here in verse 23. Everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible, but not everything is constructive. It's the same word. Not everything builds up. Love builds up, but not everything you do using your freedom necessarily builds up. He'll go on to say, eat meat in the market. Be a dinner guest with an unbeliever. Eat with thankfulness. Take things as a good gift from God. He quotes there from Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Eat without question when you're a dinner guest. But then he gets really to the summary in verses 31 through to 33. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the church of God, even as I try to please everybody in every way. For I am not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so they may be saved. Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. And really those four verses are such a fitting way to end this section. It really gathers together all the thoughts of this whole section about, yes, we have rights, yes, we have freedom, but we use them for the glory of God and for the good of others. That's the kind of overarching, that's the big headline. Live for God's glory and the good of others. That's what we want to do following Christ. We want to live for God's glory. We want to live for the good of others. Paul really talks about two things that are inseparable. They're not kind of either or. Either you live for God's glory or you live for the good of others. It's not you can pick between the two of them. They're inseparable. They're completely connected because as we live for God's glory, we will live for the good of others. So let's think about that for a moment. Do all, verse 31, for the glory of God. Do all for the glory of God. As you take your breakfast or your dinner or your lunch, as you're working as a school teacher, as a bricklayer, as you're mowing the lawns, as you're listening to Mozart, as you're at McDonald's feasting in that temple, as you're at the cinema, as you're watching a football game, as you're kicking back with Cabernet Sauvignon, as you're under a car, trying to mend the brakes. If you're over 1,000 people because you're a boss of some big organization, as you're praising together with God's people like we are this morning, do all, everything for the glory of God. As you're eating a piece of cheese, do it for the glory of God. Peanut butter on toast for the glory of God. Dr. Pepper for the glory of God. Yes, even that. Do everything, whether you eat or drink or whatever. You see, whatever excludes nothing, doesn't it? We believe God owns the world. That's a point of Paul quoting Psalm 24. This earth belongs to God. Everything belongs to God. So anything we receive, we can receive with thankfulness to God. Everything legitimate that we're not commanded to exclude from our lives, everything we can enjoy with thankfulness. We can receive it with thankfulness, and we do it to God's glory. And that means we think about how we glorify God doing all those things. Because I can run off that list, and you can all think, oh, that's interesting, but what does it actually mean to do it for the glory of God? Well, I think one thing is just simply thankfulness. You see that in verse 26, don't you? Clearly. And when Paul talks about his conscience a bit later. In Verse 30, if I take part in the meal with thankfulness, why am I denounced? Because of something I thank God for. Enjoying things for the glory of God, part of that is just saying thank you to God. It's not always that we can always see a kind of direct route where we can say, okay, I can kind of understand how I'm doing my work for the glory of God. We can see the model of that. We can see if we work diligently and with integrity, we do that for the glory of God. But what about when you're eating that piece of cheese? How do you do that for the glory of God? Well, there are some parameters, maybe don't eat greedily and all those kind of things. But in the end, the glory of God in consuming is praising God and acknowledging this is my creator. He's provided a rich fare of all kinds of foods and drinks and entertainments for me. What a good God. I glorify God as I enjoy these things. So part of glorifying God is thankfulness. And part of glorifying God is, of course, purposefulness. We do it purposefully. Whatever we're doing, we're thinking, okay, maybe not directly, but how in some way can I make God big by enjoying this thing? Maybe I just need to make God big in my own mind with my thankfulness, but maybe there's another way I can make God big. How can I bring about an exalted view of God by this thing I'm enjoying or I'm doing? Do it for the glory of God. How will people think of God better by this thing we're doing? The majestic God, the great God. How will it lead people to praise him more, to appreciate his awesome, transcendent power? How will I do this for the glory of God? Do all, says Paul, for the glory of God. But secondly, seek the good of others. Seek the good of others. Paul talked about things being beneficial, verse 24, things being constructive. Living, verse 25, not seeking our own good, but the good of others. Again, in verse 33, in the middle of that section, I'm not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved. We're free to enjoy many things for the glory of God, but also we think one of the ways I will glorify God is actually by seeking the good of others. Love builds up. Love constructs. Love looks for benefits to other people. Am I serving? Am I edifying? Am I constructing? How will this thing I'm doing, this thing I'm consuming, these words I'm saying, how will they construct and how will they destruct? Will they build up my brother? As a consequence of interacting with me at this moment, is my brother, my sister, are they more like Christ? Do they love God more? Are they encouraged? Are they challenged? Has it done them good? I've only spoken to them for 5 minutes and I've done all those things. Or after 5 minutes with me, are they discouraged, demoralized, guilty, hopeless, angry? How will this thing I'm doing leave my brother, my sister? Will they be built up? Will they be destroyed? Seek the good of others in all that you're doing, and particularly in all that you're enjoying of God's good creation. How will it affect the young Christian, what I'm doing? How will it affect the older Christian? How will it affect the person who's currently having a very difficult life, all kinds of challenges in their health or in their job or in their money situation? How will it affect them, this thing that I'm doing? How will it affect people who have a different conclusion about how the Christian should live their life? How will it affect someone who has a different view about this or that thing? How will it leave them at the end? Seek the good of others. Seek the glory of God. And that drills all the way down to our everyday choices, our everyday responses. So Paul gives these examples. They're not quite the same as the things we're living through, but verse 25, eat anything sold in the meat market without raising questions of conscience. And then verse 27, an unbeliever invites you to the meal and you want to go, eat whatever is put before you. Paul says, for meat sold in the market, eat without investigation. For meat offered when you're a dinner guest, at the house of an unbeliever, someone who doesn't worship the Lord Jesus, someone who's probably offered their meat to idols, or had the meat they bought from the butchers has been offered to idols. Still, the default reaction in both those cases, what's the default reaction? It's eat. Don't be a fussy eater. Be a potential girlfriend in the Nichols household. Don't be a fussy eater. When you go, the default is always to eat. Enjoy the good things that God gives. Don't investigate how the meat was butchered in front of the idols, perhaps. That's not your responsibility. The meat still comes directly from God. He's the one who provides it. So you don't need to take responsibility for things that other people have done. You're only taking responsibility for the things that you do. You're not obliged to investigate the origin or the motivation of everything you consume, every media you watch, everything you eat. But there are questions to ask. And here are some good questions. First of all, does what I'm doing glorify God? It's really helpful to think about those everyday situations where perhaps something may be a little bit controversial or maybe a little bit questionable or may raise questions in another Christian or in a non-Christian, to think, does this thing I'm doing still glorify God? Does it glorify God directly? Can I praise God for it? If Jesus walked in the room, maybe in some situations it might be a bit awkward if Jesus walked in the room then, but fundamentally, would you be ashamed? Can I thank God for this thing that I'm doing? Does it glorify him in some way? But also, which is the purpose particularly here, how does it affect my brother or my unbelieving friend? Paul talks about being a dinner guest where the host is not a believer, and somebody tells you that the meat's been offered to an idol. So he says the default is eat, but now somebody tells you. And you'll notice that Paul's not precise about who tells you. Is it a Christian who tells you? Is it the host who tells you? He just says someone tells you that the meat's already been offered to an idol. And Paul says in that case, don't eat. Do not eat. Why? All that stuff about freedom, all that stuff about thankfulness. But then he says, don't eat. The idols are nothing, he said that. It's not going into the temple, which is condemned by Paul, so it's not that. You don't feel a guilty conscience about it. He said that really, it's part of what he's saying, at least in verse 29, the end of verse 29. But Paul says there are other people's consciences to worry about. The same as what he's been talking about in chapter 8, verse 10. Those with a weak conscience, those who perhaps have a history with idol worship, and that meat and the association just brings back memories of worshipping idols. And when it might damage your brother or your sister, or might damage a non-believer who is confused by what you're doing, Paul says, say no to that. Don't ever, says Paul, encourage someone to sin. Don't confuse someone. The question is, does it build up my brother or my sister? Now, there are some things which are clearly wrong, and that's not really what Paul is talking about here. There's a sort of wider application of this point where if you discover something is actually wrong, then of course you're going to stop it, but that's not the case here. So if you're merrily downloading films from Popcorn, as I was discussing with Rodrigo, and they're free, and you discover that it's actually illegal, that's not clear at the moment, but if you discover they're actually illegal, then you have to stop. If your parents have told you that you shouldn't be watching films over the certificate 15, and you're around a friend's house and you're merrily watching that film, and someone tells you it's a 15 certificate, or worse, it's an 18 certificate, then you have to stop, politely. But that's not particularly what Paul's talking about here, where we actually are sort of breaking a command, either of the law or of our parents. If somebody asks you for cash in payment for doing your plumbing or something, then with a clear conscience you might give them the cash, but when they tell you, actually, I'm fiddling my VAT, then you don't give it to them. That does become, to some degree, your responsibility then. But that's not particularly what Paul's talking about there, but it's useful just to think about those things for just a moment. What Paul is talking about is something that's not intrinsically wrong, but you discover something about this thing, and you're now presented with a problem in someone else's conscience. Not that you think what you're doing is wrong, not that you've discovered that it's wrong, but you've discovered that maybe somebody else might be hindered in some way by this knowledge. And Paul says in that case, don't. People may have different views about attending a marriage that we believe is wrong. People may have different views about Halloween. We were having a good discussion in F Extra last week about Halloween. Now, we may land on a view that absolutely everything to do with Halloween is wrong, but we may also land on a view that says, okay, in principle, I'm not going to join in with this. This is a pagan, unhelpful festival that connects with all sorts of wrong thoughts about devils and demons, either trivializes them or gives them a reality that's not true. So we could say all those things, but, you know, then some friend at school gives us some sweets that are somehow connected with a Halloween party. Well, what do we do? One person may accept those, receive those with thanks. Another person may say, well, there's a whole history behind that, and I'm not happy. What do we do? Well, maybe if we don't know much of the history, and maybe if no one's confronting us with it, maybe we take the sweets. But maybe if a school friend who's a believer or a school friend who's not a believer then says, do you realize that's connected with the Halloween? Then suddenly you're confronted with it. It's not just, is this right or wrong? It's how does this affect these people and how they believe or don't believe. There's lots of areas of judgment, isn't there? Could a Christian ever be a croupier at a casino? Could a Christian ever run a pub? Train racehorses? Be a cameraman on a film that glorifies sex and violence? Print t-shirts for a stag weekend that involves strippers? These are difficult questions. Maybe they're easy questions for you. It's trivial. I've got all the answers to all those things. That's good. But sometimes it's not quite so straightforward, is it? And Paul is adding another layer of thought here. Not just, let's work out, is this thing right or is this thing wrong for me? It's thinking, how will this affect other people who see me there? I train racehorses, I don't have any interest in gambling. Does anybody know that? People will see me and think the whole world of horse racing, which is intrinsically connected with gambling, I think, is on show when I'm training racehorses, I think. But, you know, there's judgment there. But I don't just think whether it's right or wrong. I think, how does this affect my brother, my sister, who's watching? How does this affect an unbeliever? Will an unbeliever think this is just hypocrisy? You say one thing and you do something completely different. So that's a really great question to ask. How will it affect others? And in particular, thinking about the unbeliever, will this thing I'm participating in, or not participating in, will it help more people get saved? Paul says that really explicitly in verse 33. Verse 32, do not cause anyone to stumble. Don't put any obstacles in anyone's way. And then verse 33, even as I try to please everybody in every way, for I am not seeking my own good, but the good of many. Why? In this case, so that they may be saved. Paul says, by trying to glorify God and do good, of course, I'm not trying to hinder my brother. I'm not trying to cause my brother to sin. But also, at the same time, by trying to be consistent and love God and love people, I'm trying to bring many people to know and love Jesus. And I don't want to put any obstacle in their way. I don't want to put obstacles in the way of Christians in the church. I don't want to put an obstacle in the way of a Jew who might be confused, perplexed by what I'm doing. I don't want to put an obstacle in the way of a Gentile, a non-Jewish person. I want to remove all the obstacles I could possibly remove. Not the offense of the cross, not the challenge of the uniqueness of Jesus, but every other obstacle, I want to clear them out of the way, he says. We are in an election period. It's been a bit of a slow, dull one, in my opinion, so far, but it may be getting a little bit more interesting, but we really are in that period. And I remember Tony Blair giving a speech before one of his victories, quite a long way back, and he talked about how in the previous election, the last one that Margaret Thatcher won, he was talking about how in the previous election he had gone around campaigning, and this is a famous thing that he said. He said he spoke to someone, it was either Mondeo man or it was White Van man or something like that, saw someone kind of washing their car, and he realised in talking to this bloke that Labour weren't going to win that year, because he realised that this guy washing his car, small businessman, was completely contented, completely happy with his life. And he realised that they were going to lose. And he realised, I think very skillfully, that we need to reconnect with those kind of people. And of course, he was quite successful with that. There's an obvious assumption behind what Paul says in verse 27 and then in verse 33, that he expects Christians in Corinth to interact with non-Christians, clearly. He expects them to go to meals. He expects them to be living in a way that will save people. Who gets saved? Well, non-Christian people get saved, don't they? People who aren't currently saved get saved. So he expects informally, slightly more formally, in terms of proclamation, in all kinds of ways, he expects the Christians in Corinth to be interacting with the non-Christians, to be meeting White Van man or Mondeo man or whatever they're driving now, man, and understanding their world. Understanding why are they content? Why does the gospel have nothing to do with it? I was chatting with the guys who serviced my car, and I've done that. They've served it regularly. It's quite a small company, so you can go there and have a chat and have a cup of coffee, and I give them biscuits at Christmas. Very generous of me. And I'm hoping, actually, during the sabbatical to spend a bit of time with them. They said you couldn't stand it because we swear too much. But I said, no, I did go to school. It's all right. But the thing is about those guys, and if they ever listen to this, I don't think they mind me saying it, the gospel has absolutely no interest to them. It doesn't connect with their world at all at the moment. Well, please God, it might if I'm under a car and they drop an engine on me and I don't swear. Maybe it might just connect a little bit with them. But unless we interact with people, the gospel won't connect because they're quite contented polishing their cars. They don't think they need Jesus. They don't think they need to be saved. We need to get out and to engage. And somehow. And part of the obstacle to that is sometimes our wanting to keep in our own safe world. And Paul says, go to the meal. If you want to go to this meal of an unbeliever, go there and don't be an awkward guest. Christians can sometimes just be awkward. And of course, there are good things we need to stand up for and not participate in. But in other ways, we can just be awkward because we're legalists. And Paul says, make yourself an accessible, a nice guest to have around. Make it easy, more generally, to be your friend. Is it easy to be friends with you? Or are you prickly and awkward and full of loads of rules and judge everybody and complain about everybody and everything? How easy are you to get on with? Of course, it's easier in the church if you're nicer to get on with, but especially in terms of the proclamation of the gospel, be someone who's easy to invite around. Well, I don't want to invite them around because they're just awkward. No, I really want to invite them around because they're such a lovely guest. They just get on, they eat the food, they talk to the people, they're very complimentary about things, they don't boast about themselves. Be a wonderful guest for the glory of God, for the good of others, so they might get saved. Because people really do think, if they think anything about Christianity at all, they think it is about rules and regulations. And sometimes, inadvertently, by mistake, we just reinforce that. We say it's about grace. But what they see is it's about rules. And they need to see that it's about grace and love and wanting people to be saved for the glory of Christ. And kind of connected with that, It's worth asking this question about being judgmental. It's implied there in verse 13. Paul says, if I take part in the meal with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of something I thank God for? Why should my freedom be judged by another's conscience? Paul says, absolutely, I'm round an unbeliever's house. I'm told that the meat's been offered to idols. Absolutely, you need to say no. And he gives... he's been given the reasons, really, in this whole section. So we've got there. But he also says something else which is very interesting, which is, I am clear in my conscience about it, and I can thank God for it. And yes, I am going to not eat it because of the sake of the other person's conscience. Probably it's a believer he's talking about here, but it may be just to confuse a non-believer. But he's saying, I will not eat, but actually I should not, in principle, be judged for this, because I can eat this thing with thankfulness. So it's worth just kind of teasing out of that, that Paul is saying, just beware of judging other people and the choices they've made. Paul says, it's my responsibility to work with your tender conscience, but in this case, you really shouldn't be judging me. Now, Paul's not saying, whatever I feel is good to do, I can just do. You know, every Christian just does what they want to do. It's down to their own conscience. Of course, our consciences need to be informed by God's word. And sometimes another person, another Christian, needs to come into our life and say, I can see what you're doing and it doesn't look right as far as I can see from God's word. We need people like that. But Paul's not talking about that here. He's talking about how when it clearly is a matter of conscience, clearly is a matter that he has resolved and thought through God's will on it, and still he's being judged. And we are very prone, I am very prone, to judge others for the choices that they've made. For the luxuries that they have. For how they choose to spend their time. For what they say. For what they do, for what they let their children do or not let their children do. We're very quick to judge. And Paul is saying, be very careful to do that. It's not the only thing to think about in interacting with people, but it's one of the things to think about. Don't be quick to judge another man's conscience. So, do all for the glory of God. Seek the good of others. How do I live for the glory of God? How do I live for the good of others? I want them to be built up. I want them to be saved. I want to put nothing in their way that will stop them being converted. I want to think about all my activities. There are lots of things that are not wrong. It's not wrong to spend all day surfing on Facebook or going through box sets of DVDs or playing Grand Theft Auto. Maybe there is something wrong with Grand Theft Auto. But is that constructive? Does that build others up? And does it allow me to glorify God? When I'm drinking, what I'm watching, where I'm surfing, the luxuries I have, my eating out, my technology, all these things I can enjoy with thankfulness, but are they for the glory of God? Are they for the good of others, all people, but particularly also, do they lead people to be more likely to be saved, to see Jesus in me? And that's where Paul ends, isn't it? Follow godly examples as they follow Christ. Paul says, follow my example, chapter 11, verse 1, which really fits with the section above it. Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. You don't need to live very long as a Christian before you look at other Christians, and in some cases you see great role models, and you look up to those people. There are people in this church that we look up to as great role models. And some of the younger Christians here need to seek out people and to observe people and see people who are following Christ. It's great to follow the example of others who are themselves following Christ. Some of us who are a bit older, some of us who are parents, some of us who are grandparents need to think, am I a good role model in my attendance at church? In my attitude, in my habits, in the way I speak about people, am I a good example? Some of us older people need to really think about that. We kind of think we've done it, we've arrived at this kind of midpoint in our Christian life and we're coasting along. Well, we need to think, how are other people seeing me? When they see me, do they think grumpy old man, grumpy old woman, complainer, grumbler, misery, judgmental? Do they think that, or do they think, this person, they're such a great role model to me. They love Jesus, they love people. Think how you can be a great role model. But of course, the best example is Christ. And Paul is quick to say that. Follow my example as I follow Christ, in as much as I follow Christ. Of course, don't follow my example in everything I've ever done, because I have sinned, Paul says, and I still struggle with sin. But in as much as I follow Christ, and as I try and follow Christ, follow my example. We all seek to be like Christ. I think it's something we don't always think about so much. We're so eager to be clear that Jesus Christ paid the penalty for our sin, that Jesus Christ is risen and in heaven. And we want to emphasize that and say that it's nothing about Jesus Christ just being an example to us. But you know, Jesus is an example to us. His righteousness that he gives us is an example to us. And we often need to think about, not only am I saved by Christ, but am I following the example of Christ? Did Christ live for the glory of God? Did Christ live for the good of men and women, that they might be saved? He did. And does he lead us in this? He does. Follow the example of Christ as he lives for the glory of his Father, always seeking to do the will of his Father. Follow Christ as he lives for the good of men, that they might be saved. Follow Christ as he interacts with people who are not believers, as he eats meals with them and confronts them only with the truth, not with his awkwardness. Follow Christ as your perfect example, as well as your perfect Savior. Do all for the glory of God. Seek the good of others. Follow godly examples as they follow Christ.